Okay, we're reading from Philippians chapter 1, starting at verse 12. And then I can't find it, it's after Ephesians. I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel, so that it has become known throughout the whole imperial guard and to all the rest that my imprisonment is for Christ. And most of the brothers, having become confident in the Lord by my imprisonment, are much more bold to speak the word without fear. Some indeed preach Christ from envy and rivalry, but others from goodwill. The latter do it out of love, knowing that I am put here for the defense of the gospel. The former proclaim Christ out of rivalry, not sincerely, but thinking to afflict me in my imprisonment. What then? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is proclaimed, and in that I rejoice. Yes, and I will rejoice, for I know that through your prayers and the help of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, this will turn out for my deliverance, as it is my eager expectation and hope that I will not be at all ashamed, but that with full courage, now as always, Christ will be honoured in my body, whether by life or by death. For to me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. If I am to live in the flesh, that means fruitful labour for me. Yet which I shall choose, I cannot tell. I am hard pressed between the two. My desire is to depart and be with Christ, for that is far better. But to remain in the flesh is more necessary on your account. Convinced of this, I know that I will remain and continue with you all, for your progress and joy in the faith, so that in me you may have ample cause to glory in Christ Jesus because of my coming to you again.
And Philippians 1. And no page in your booklet. In fact, actually, no page is tricky because we are doing point D of last night. So if you just arrived and you think you missed all last night, you didn't. We're going to do point D tonight. In fact, if you've missed it, we need a little bit of a recap. So what you need to do actually is take the book and look at the picture on the front. That will give you basically what we said last night, that picture. The guy next to Mel Gibson, I'm sure I recognise. Does he come to St Helens? There was something very familiar about him. Anyway, that is what we said last night, the United We Stand picture. We actually watched a bit of 300 and said the picture in Philippians is of a shield wall. So they don't have shields because they're Scottish and they can't afford them. Sorry, Katrina. Look at that. That is a look. So the image is of standing together, firm and solid. Nothing's going to frighten us. Nothing's going to push us back. And we're united in the sense of shield locked over shield, all standing together. But it is for a purpose. That's one of the things we said last night. It was pointed out to me that it may have sounded like I decided it was for that purpose because I found unity and standing firm dull, which is, I didn't quite say that, but I didn't find they quite set me as much on fire as what I worked out Philippians was really saying. So the issue is what's Philippians really saying, which is the unity, the standing firm, is for a purpose. They're not just there to shout. They are there to contend, to strive for the gospel, it says, which is the best sort of purpose in the world. That is what Christians are about. The one thing, the only thing, is to strive for the faith of the gospel, to contend for it. To get to, we said chapter 1, we said that meant speaking to people, proclaiming Christ to them, offering them Jesus, arguing with them maybe, defending Jesus, so that a friend hears the gospel. So that a friend hears about Jesus Christ, who we've just sung about, all those songs, the King, the one who is with us. So they know about Jesus Christ, who can forgive them, who can make them citizens of heaven. We said that is the point in being a Christian. That is the point in doing things together. That is what we are all about, is to strive for that, which is a brilliant, brilliant thing, isn't it? To stand for the gospel, to be united together, and to strive for our friends to come to know Jesus. So that's the picture. But we said, just if you've got chapter 1, the end of chapter 1 open, we said there is suffering involved in verse 29 and verse 30. Granted to suffer for his sake, and verse 30, engaged in the same conflict you saw I had, and now here I still have. And that is roughly where we're going today with the early bit of chapter 1. Basically, Paul understands what it is like to try and contend for the gospel, strive for the gospel, and how hard that is. I don't know what that calls to mind for you, the moments when you are really down about the gospel, when nobody seems to be listening. I don't know if you talked in the long-haul seminar about how much harder it is when you get out of student times. You may not believe this. I think it's really hard now to tell people the gospel. But imagine that moment in 2 years' time when you're in the office and you realize nobody has time to talk about Jesus and nobody wants to talk to the office junior about anything anyway, let alone about Jesus. And maybe then at the same time, or maybe now at university, your friends who seem to be interested, they suddenly tell you to back off, or they suddenly completely misremember everything you talked about before. Sorry, forget is the word for misremember, isn't it, in English? Forget what you talked about. It seemed like they said, maybe, yes, I'm a sinner, maybe I need forgiving. Somehow that's suddenly become too hard and they've forgotten. Or maybe your family turned genuinely hostile to the gospel. I've got a comedy family. Here's the latest thing. I genuinely don't think she began doing this to get at me. But I have a cousin who's she writes novels. She just started doing this in her retirement. She told me her latest book she might want to come to St. Helens and do some research for. I was looking on her website a couple of days ago. And her next novel is advertised as about a fundamentalist vicar who loses his faith. And all her novels, because she used to do some psychological sexual stuff, have that sort of angle too. So basically, it looks like she's writing a book about me. That will probably include me being a fundamentalist and having some massive sex problem. So there you go. That may not be everyone's family experience in terms of opposition to the gospel. Buy that book. You want to buy it now, do you? There you go. But it can be that sense you're really down on the gospel. This is really hard. This is really difficult. And when that is going on, nothing makes it worse than the idea that maybe you are the only one this is happening to. The sense that everybody else maybe is having an easy time defending the gospel and preaching Christ. And if you think that is hugely crushing. Sometimes Christians can give that impression. Maybe particularly Christians trying to train you to help you tell people the gospel. So they say maybe there's a way of avoiding the hassles. Or if you stop being quite so dogmatic, or if you took the time to love people properly, or if you answered the questions this way, or if you went for dialogue rather than preaching at people, then it would be easy, there'd be no struggle. And Paul says no, this is the same struggle he had, the same struggle he had when he was with them, the same struggle that he has now, the same struggle they have, the same struggle we all have. Which is where verses 12 to 26 of chapter 1 fit in the book. He's going to tell us about his conflict, his struggling, his suffering, because it's the same one that the Philippians have. We're going to look at the stuff about Paul, and we're going to learn from it. I'll show you that we're allowed to do that in Philippians. Look at verse 3, so chapter 3, verse 17. Do you ever wonder why Paul puts so much about himself in his letters? Actually, there's several different reasons. In Philippians, here's the reason. 3, verse 17, brothers, join in imitating me and keep your eyes on those who walk according to the example you have in us. Or flip the page, 4 verse 9. What you have learned and received and heard and seen in me, practice these things and the God of peace will be with you. Here's the visual aid. Paul is the visual aid. And we're going to spend lots of time tonight looking at Paul, who is a crazy, crazy man. That's what this bit is called, I think, in the notes, crazy talk. We've got 2 points, 2 things he says that I think are particularly crazy, and they map onto the 2 sort of training aims. So we need to strive, we need to be a good shield wall, therefore we need to be united, and we need to stand firm. And his 2 bits of crazy talk one each about each of those things. And what we're going to be doing is looking at this crazy man's life, because Paul wants you to be like him. He wants you to be this crazy. We're not going to pretend he's not a complete lunatic as we look at what he says. Well, the next two talks, we'll see why he says it. But it is bafflingly, enormously huge what he says. But he has it there to say, in the middle of the struggle, this is what you should be like. Be like me, is what he's saying. So before we go there into the first one, have a look in, open up again, chapter 1, verse 12. I just want to get the background to what is going on. We said some of this last night. The background is that Paul is in prison, verse 13, and he is facing a death sentence. So somewhere in a room in Rome, there is a bald man in a toga who probably in the next couple of weeks, as Paul is writing this, is going to decide whether to execute him or not, whether he lives or dies. But in the middle of that, when Paul writes about prison, he doesn't complain about that. He doesn't complain about the normal prison things, the food or the stress with the guards. He is worried about the Philippians, verse 12. I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel. We can see how crazy he is. He's in prison. He might be killed. He's most worried about how his Philippian friends are going to think, because he's worried that maybe they'll think God has made a mistake, or maybe they'll think God can't rescue his people, which would be a bit stupid, because the second family to become Christians in Philippi, do you remember the story? The second family that does is the jailer. The local jailer and his family, because Paul was arrested, put in prison, and God arranged an earthquake to get Paul out of prison and convert the jailer and his family. But still Paul is worried. Don't worry, God's making mistakes. Sorry. He says there's two good things have come out of him being in prison. And verse 13 is the first one. Verse 13, how do you get the gospel into the imperial household? If you had to make a plan of how to get the gospel into Caesar's palace, what would you do? How do you evangelize the places that are most dangerous for Christians? Well, here we go. What better way than to arrange for the Roman government to transport your best preacher all the way from Jerusalem to Rome in a prison ship, but they paid the bill. Then you put him up in a room in the palace full time. The room happens to be a prison cell, but it is local. And then you arrange for him to spend all his time chained to members of the imperial staff. Okay, they're guards guarding him, but there they are, and they're there all day, and they have to listen to him talk about Jesus. And verse 13, it is clear, known throughout the whole imperial guard and to all the rest, that my imprisonment is for Christ. Just a bit of an aside there about bad things being good things, bad things being for advantage. How are we ever going to get the, how many is it, nearly a billion or more Muslims in the world to hear the gospel, properly hear it, have a chance to actually sit down and talk about it, become Christians? Missionaries aren't allowed into lots of countries, not allowed into Iran, not allowed into Saudi Arabia. I think that Paul would pray for a way in, and on Paul's list would be maybe the most efficient way. Maybe God would allow you to be arrested and taken right to the heart of things. Isn't that an odd way of thinking about it? Isn't he a crazy man? But doesn't that make some sense? Or in this country. In this country, we often think, don't we, that English people are Christian because it comes naturally to them somehow, and that sort of our Muslim neighbours are hard and scary to talk to. Now, I'm sure you know this about... I'm going to do some English history. Sorry about that. Particularly sorry if you're not English by upbringing. You probably know this already. We have this huge cultural blindness about what it is to be English. Here's some history. The English were not always Christian. Okay, did you know that? I guess you knew that. This country, in fact, was not always English. And this country was full of lovely Christian British people, Welsh people, who lived in their little Welsh huts all over England, all over here, and living their lovely, lovely British lives, Christian lives. And then all these hairy, brutal English people turned up. And they weren't Christians, and they began to beat up the Welsh and steal all their stuff and made them go and live in damp, cold, horrible places like Wales and Scotland. That's just true. And the ones they didn't drive away, they enslaved, and Britain stopped being a Christian country. And history goes a bit quiet at that point, because mainly because the hairy English used the books to wipe their bums with. So there aren't any books after that for a bit. But there are signs that the British didn't give up being Christians, including the British who now lived as slaves of the hairy English. In fact, we know that some of them did missionary work, because that is how the Irish became Christians, is that a British guy called Patrick got captured, enslaved, released, went to Ireland. The Irish became Christians. Then the Irish began evangelising the English. And actually, that was much more significant than that place in Canterbury where some monks arrived that you may have heard of. Canterbury Cathedral, what's that? No, anyway. Now, we don't know how it worked quite, but you wonder if there were some British people who were a bit like Paul. And when the English arrived and made them their slaves, they began evangelising these hairy thugs who'd stolen their land, and praying for them, maybe, and loving them rather than hating them. Certainly, it is odd, isn't it? You don't expect the conquerors to end up with the religion of the people they've just squashed. That is bizarre. We have English place names, the English language. We have pagan names for our days of the week, pagan everything. But we have this Christian religion because somehow the Christians in the country carried on believing, carried on evangelising. Now, the Daily Mail gets really excited, doesn't it, that maybe the Muslims are coming somehow and Britain will become a Muslim country and drive the Christians out and all of that. And I don't think there's very much evidence for that at all, but perhaps they will. And perhaps that is God's brilliant plan. Could that be God's brilliant plan? It's very hard for me to talk to my Muslim neighbour about Jesus when I am the superior oppressor whose government and governments like mine are around dropping bombs on Muslims in other countries. That is very hard for him when I'm here as the sort of person in position of power. How much easier it would be if he had nicked my house and beat me up and I was living in his cellar doing his potatoes. And isn't that crazy talk? But isn't that where Paul goes? What would be for the advantage of the gospel? What would it be that would mean that people become Christians? Do you see how crazy Paul is? And that is just the background. Because here he's just started being crazy. Here's the main thing I want us to see. Point one is that rivals make him rejoice. So that is verse 14. So you see, let me just recap. So prison has advanced the gospel directly because Paul gets to speak to these important Romans about Jesus. But it also advanced it indirectly, verse 14, because people have become more confident in the Lord by my imprisonment and are much more bold to speak the word without fear. And it's happened to two different groups, verses 15 to 18. And I'm not going to bother too much with the ones who really love Paul. I think those ones, Paul's been put in prison. They love him so much. They want his mission to go on. They think if he's prepared to go through that, we'll go through it too. I'm not bothered by those ones. It's quite impressive, but I'm not interested. I want the rival group. Do you see them? Some, verse 15, preach Christ from envy and rivalry, but others from goodwill. Verse 16, the goodwill people. Verse 17 and 18, the bad will people, the rivalry people. So here is Paul's example for us to imitate, which fits the unity theme, how to be one-spirited. What is it you do when you are in the shield wall and you are contending for the gospel, and then one of the enemies gives you a clout on the head, that's like Paul being sent to prison, and when that happens, all your mates around you go, yes! What do you do then? When they go, yes, Paul has been sent to prison, now I can steal his place on the team. How dysfunctional are the university sports teams at the moment? How much of this goes on? Do you see in the papers today? So this is there's a heavy book. This is Ronaldo crashing his car. I think not actually, that's not him crashing his car. That is his car, though. How many members of his team do you think, when they first heard that on the news, secretly went, yes? Not just the ones who don't like him because he's arrogant and got us kicked out of the World Cup and all that sort of thing, but because maybe they'd get to take his place. Does that happen in university sports teams? The lead forward injures his foot, and there's this sort of ripple effect down the other teams. Anyone who's ever scored a goal in their life thinks, well, maybe this could be my moment. It happens in theatre, doesn't it? The star loses their voice, and the understudy moves in and is rejoicing. It certainly happens in politics. Gordon Brown drops the ball, and everyone else is looking about how they're going to move up the rung. And this is what's happened to Paul. Verse 15, they're rivals, they're envious. They've always been envious of him. Paul is, hi, come on in. There'll be a seat somewhere. Shall we all look? Hello. Welcome. Verse 15, they've always been envious of him. He's successful. All these people become Christians through him in places like Philippi. And then when Paul is put out of the way in prison, they suddenly up their game. Suddenly that is their moment. And they preach Christ out of envy and rivalry. While the team captain's in prison, let's muscle in on his patch and show everyone that we are what you need in the team now. At verse 17, they preach Christ out of rivalry, not sincerely, but thinking to afflict Paul in his imprisonment. Do you hear that? They are preaching Christ just to make Paul feel bad, just to make things worse for him. They want him to lose his place on the team. They want him to get dropped. They want to be able to say, look how many people we've converted. We're better than him. He hasn't done many of his famous journeys recently, has he? Where's he? He's not moved from that room. Not so impressive now. And you see the danger to the shield wall if people aren't in one spirit like that. Do you see how this would tear the thing apart? Tear the church apart. See, there is Paul in his prison cell. He's gloomy, he's lonely, and he's fed up. And all he has to do is just lash out at them, just a little bit. See how easy that would be? He must have felt pretty sore when he heard what they were doing. And all he's got to do is write, I, Paul, your apostle, I command you to separate from these nasty people. That's all he's got to do. He's got to write that. I command you to have nothing to do with them. And that is all it would take. And then you wouldn't have a shield wall anymore, would you? He's just got to say that. And the whole thing is over. You've just got a split, hopeless mess. Just think how much it must have hurt Paul. Don't know if you've ever had something you deserved robbed from you. Don't know if you've ever been, you know, maybe it was. You had a place in a team. You were better. Someone knew the captain better. You lost your place. Yet that sort of feeling of, I've been robbed. Or maybe you've ever had someone do a campaign of, let's bring them down. Unfairly, unjustly, whispering stuff about you, building up a bad image of you, trying to knock you down. Just try and imagine how much it would have hurt for Paul. And then think just how right he would have been to do that, in a sense. How right, how much in the right. He's been accused of bad motives. They're trying to nick his place. And when that happens, when normally someone points that out that I've done that, normally there's at least, 50% of unfairness in it. I can say, no, I was doing it for good motives because of this and this and this. These guys are badly motivated. It would be absolutely fair if Paul just laid it out and said, look at these people. Every time they stood up to preach Christ, it's just because they want Paul's spot. It's just because of rivalry. And it matters. So if you do something that is good from a wrong motive, the Bible says it is wrong. The Bible says that is sin. It's not a good deed. God is not pleased. So all Paul has to do is write and say, have nothing to do with them. They're trying to cause me trouble. Just get rid of them, will you? He must have wanted, don't you think he must have wanted to write that so much. And all he'd have to do and the whole shield wall would be gone. The whole Mediterranean church in every Greek and Roman town would be split apart. All he has to do is write what he really, really wants to. But what does he write? He writes verse 18. Look at verse 18. Verse 18. What then? What does it matter? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is proclaimed, and in that I rejoice. Do you see it? The crazy talk. Rivals make me rejoice. They try and nick his place, they try and make him look bad, and he sits there rejoicing. He's pleased. Do you see how the one-spirited thing saves Paul and saves the shield wall? See, all he cares about is striving for the gospel. That is the most important thing. Nothing else matters except that they keep striving for the gospel. People hear about Jesus, people get forgiven, people get their place in heaven. People get to know Jesus. That is all that matters. So if the rivals stamp all over him and then head off and preach Christ, it doesn't matter to Paul. In fact, he'll rejoice. It's a good thing. And do you see how his attitude keeps the shield wall together? Could you have done that? That crazy, crazy attitude keeps the whole thing together. And in chapter 2, we'll see the real secret see why it is Paul can do that. Don't you want to know? What is it in Paul's head that means he can look at these rivals and say, you know, go for it. Have my place. Have what you want. It's absolutely fine. Now, you don't have to be around churches for long to know that they are not always like this. To know that they get in huge trouble and fighting and arguing among themselves and power games. I could tell you about the rivalries in the CU when I was a student, but to be honest, some of them were a bit boring because by then, by that age, we had learned to keep inside what we really thought and not say it out loud. I would recommend that, by the way. That is less explosive. It's just as sinful when you think it inside and don't say it. But the school stories are more fun. So school CU. I spent 3 years with a school Christian union locked in a power struggle, absolutely naked power struggle, with the teacher who ran the group. Because he was a design technology teacher, he spoke funny, that sort of thing. I thought he wasn't great. And I used to say things like, look, why don't I invite all the speakers? Or saying things which, you know, in my head were cleverly concealed, so he couldn't really tell what I was thinking. But I said things like, this group doesn't grow very much. Maybe it's because we are not cool enough. Maybe there's another teacher that could come and help us. Stuff like that. What I definitely did say out loud, here's another example, what I did say out loud was that there was a guy 2 years older than me at the school who was helping organise the group, but he was a fairly recent Christian. And we were having a prayer meeting one time, and I turned up 1 Timothy 3 verse 6. Just turn there. 1 Timothy 3 verse 6 is, what is it, 3 books further on? Maybe 4 books further on. It's page 1194 in my Bible, and I read out 1 Timothy 3 verse 6. It's about leaders. It's about leaders and who should be leaders. I read out 1 Timothy 3 verse 6. He must not be a recent convert. And I said that out loud in this group. And I meant, and everybody understood that I meant, that I should be in charge and not him. Absolutely clear what I meant, which is ironic. Look how the verse finishes. Or he may become puffed up with conceit, which is interesting. And that is how the shield wall comes crashing down, doesn't it, in churches? If you've lived through a church like that, or lived through a church split, or an argument like that, I guess you know all about this. The shield wall comes crashing down. And these guys Paul is talking about, they're a lot like me when I was at school, I think, and a lot like me most of the time still. Want to preach Christ, but often from the wrong motives. And actually, if you we drew our team, should we get it back up again? That's the shield wall. These are all Christians around there. If you're in any sort of Christian organisation, if you're in any sort of church, certainly this one, and you're trying to strive for the gospel with other people, chances are all of the people in the ring around you have wrong motives at some point or other. Chances are every time that something goes well, they're wishing that they'd done it. Chances are every time you just do something good or right, or someone recognises what you've done, they're wishing it was them. I know it's like that because I'm like that, and because I talk to people who are like that. I guess you, maybe you thought it was just you. It is all of us. And the shield wall could come crashing down. The team could be destroyed. The people who aren't Christians in your university could learn that actually the people in the Christian Union can't even organise a Bible study without fighting and competing. And what saves the team is that Paul cares more about people hearing about Jesus than he does about anything else. So he rejoices. So here's the thing. Can you imitate the crazy man? Could you do this? Could you do what Paul does? Are the people who compete with you right now, are the people in your Christian union or your church at home who compete with you or your family, could you be one-spirited and say that as long as Christ is being preached, I will let them trample all over my reputation, all over my spots, as long as that, and I'll rejoice. Christian Union committees, they're being chosen this month, is that right? This month you'll find out who gets to be on the committee and who isn't. What if somebody else puts you down so as to try and get a spot rather than you? What if they ruin your reputation, slag you off, do a load of Christian stuff that you know is just showing off to try and look better than you to get the spot? Are you crazy enough to rejoice that they'll get that job and do Christian stuff with it? Could you do that? Are you crazy enough? Or are other versions, who gets asked to lead Bible studies? Who gets to read stuff in church? Who gets to be an associate? We were just talking about that, weren't we? Who's the sort of full-time super thing? It's not extra super, it's just different.
Who gets to give talks? Who gets known as someone who's good at having friends come and hear about Jesus? Are you crazy enough to say that rivals make you rejoice? It's hard, isn't it? Isn't that hard? Isn't this crazy, crazy talk? That's why we'll need the training in chapter 2 tomorrow. Point 2, verses 19 to 26. This is the second bit of crazy talk. Let me read you verse 21 again. Verse 21, "For to me to live is Christ and to die is gain. For me to live is Christ and to die is gain." That is Paul's attitude to life. And this is his secret to standing firm. So the first one was be united. The second one is stand firm. Just remind yourself how crazy this is. Okay, Paul is in a prison cell, and Paul is having the sort of conversation you might well have with yourself in prison about what the future is going to hold. So I'm in prison, and they're talking about the death sentence for me. So here is a sensible question. I wonder what is going to happen to me. That is a sense. Hey, there's people there. is there anyone can go and help them? Are they trying to... Where are they trying to get to, do you think?
Here.
There we go. They may be trying to find the funny huts. That might set an alarm off. Let's just let them go around the building. Should we wave? Everyone just wave. There we go. Good. Let's start over again, shall we? So Paul is in prison. And it is absolutely sensible. If you were a life coach for Paul, for him to wonder what the future is going to hold. Am I going to get killed or not? Sensible question. Verse 22 is a stupid question, though. Verse 22. Because verse 22 says, which shall I choose? See that at the end of verse 22? Isn't that a stupid question? So I wonder if I'm going to die or not. That makes sense. I wonder which I want. That's what he's asking. I wonder if I would rather be killed, or I wonder if I would rather be allowed to live. Yet which I shall choose, I cannot tell. You think it should be obvious what he should want, what he should pray for. He should pray, I want to live. But Paul isn't so sure. He's absolutely sure God's going to answer his prayers. Verse 19, I know that through your prayers and the help of the Spirit, there is a powerful combination. He's sure this will turn out for my deliverance. Verse 19. You think, hooray, they've prayed for him to be released. The Spirit's going to make sure it happens. And he's sure about his deliverance. Maybe he's had a vision or something, means he knows he's going to be let out. And then you read verse 20. As it is my eager expectation and hope that I will not at all be ashamed, but with full courage now as always, Christ will be honored in my body, whether by life or by death. What Paul means by deliverance is that he'll not be ashamed, whatever happens. That would be rescue. Deliverance for Paul is having enough courage to honour Christ in his body, whether by life or by death. Just notice, he is genuinely scared of death. He is worried about whether he'll be ashamed or not. He needs full courage, it says. Paul is not psychopathic. He doesn't have some sort of bit missing in his head that is the scared of death bit. He's normal. But there is some abnormal, crazy reason driving him that means he says, I really don't know which one would be better, live or die, because something else has captured him so hugely. So that all that really matters is striving to the end, whether that end looks like release or like death. And he can say that because of his basic attitude, verse 21. To live is Christ, and to die is gain. Living is good because living is Christ. He gets to serve Christ and know Christ and do things for Christ. But dying is pure gain. Verse 23, I am hard pressed between the two. My desire is to depart and be with Christ. That's the thing he wants most, is to know Jesus more and more. And that is going to happen when he dies. So surely that's what he should be praying for. But then verse 24, he remembers he might still have stuff to do, useful things to do now, more necessary on your account. So that's where he ends up. Do you get the sort of bouncing around? I'd love to die, but actually I've got useful things to do while I'm alive, because being alive is Christ. Necessary things for your account. Verse 25, I know I'll remain and will continue with you all for your progress and joy in the faith. He thinks he'll live, be released, and come and help them. Now, isn't that an amazing, crazy way to talk?
It's an amazing conversation to be able to have with your death literally in the hands of the bald man in the toga in the room upstairs. To be able to have that kind of conversation. Here's my honest version. I think my version of Paul's driving principle, for me to live is Charlie and to die is a waste. I think that's more like my honest way I live my life. I don't know if you could say anything different. So yes, I do a bunch of Christian things with my life. But deep down, I'm not sure that is the reason I want to stay alive. I think I want to stay alive because of me and all the me things that are fun and all the me things that I still want to do. To live is Charlie. And I believe that Jesus can beat death. And I believe that when I die, I will be with him. I believe those things passionately and definitely. But I still, most of me, thinks that my death would be a disaster. That I might dress it up again. You know, I've got loads of Christian stuff I still need to do. Or I might say, I'm going to look after Tom and I'm going to look after Claire and stay with her. But deep down, I mean, this life is mine. And I want it, and for it to be taken away too soon would be a waste. There's a great little book by John Piper that is not on the bookstall. There you go. But it's called Don't Waste Your Life. And you look at a title like that, Don't Waste Your Life, and you think, maybe this is great. This is going to tell me how to pass my exams and be organized and do my work and all that sort of thing. But that is not what it means at all. One of the chapters is called Don't Waste Your Cancer. Don't Waste Your Cancer. And you see, Paul says he wants sufficient courage to honour Christ in his body. I wonder if you could think like that. Think like Paul. So that when you find out you have cancer, maybe, the really big question would be, how can Christ be honoured in this cancer? Isn't that crazy? That's what the chapter in that book's about. There's a really good opportunity to say to all my friends, look, I'm going to be dead soon. Where are you going to go when you die? What a brilliant opportunity. Could you think like that? I wonder how I can rig my funeral so that some of my friends have to think about Jesus if they come along to the funeral. Or I must remember to talk honestly to all my friends about how painful it is, but how much praying and knowing Jesus Christ is keeping me going. Have that at the top of your agenda. Isn't that an amazing, crazy thing to think? Except the more you hang around with Christians, the more you find there are lots of crazy people. Lots of crazy people around. I saw a good friend on Tuesday who is my age, which is still quite young for this sort of thing, just if you're not aware of that. And he's got two kids, and his wife is battling with cancer. She's just been in for a load of radiotherapy and all the horrible stuff that goes with that. And Becca has been telling everyone and not wanting to waste it and getting her neighbours talking and wanting to show people how a Christian looks at death. It hasn't, here's the issue on the shield wall, it hasn't pulled her away from standing firm. Death cannot do that to her because to live is Christ and to die is gain. See, there's the issue. If life now is Christ and death is gain, then nothing is going to be able to knock Paul off standing firm. And the enemies, that's the other bit of the drawing, if you joined since yesterday, those are the enemies. They really have their work cut out if they want to frighten you, if your life philosophy is to live is Christ and to die is gain. So if live is Christ, then your whole life is about being useful to other people. Tell them the gospel, help them live as Christians, all the stuff Paul's doing here, interested in their progress. So prison isn't bad, as long as you can be useful to Jesus Christ inside. The only bad thing would be not being able to be useful to Jesus Christ, because that would be not living anymore. I guess in how this affects us, I know there are some degrees, like a sociology degree maybe, where to stand up for Christian stuff, take a Bible viewpoint, might mean you lose marks, might mean you lose the respect of your tutors, might mean you lose the grade you wanted. Well, that's not bad. It is wrong and unjust, and so is Paul being in prison. It's horrendous. But it's not bad, because to live is Christ, and life is not about middle-class achievements. Life is about Christ and being useful. There's nothing wrong with middle-class achievements. It's a good thing. Achieve whatever you can. But that's not life. Life is Christ. Same even in more personal things. If somebody says, come out of the shield wall or I will cease to be your friend. Come out of the shield wall or you will cease to be a valuable member of our family.
come out of the shield wall, or you can no longer have your job, your status, my respect. Well, the crazy lunatic who says to live is Christ, just, well, none of those things, they're all very painful, but none of those things are my life. So you can't pull me out of the wall with any of those. It's crazy talk, isn't it? But could you imitate it? And how about death? If death is gain, well, then the enemies are going to have to try really, really hard to frighten you. In fact, it may well turn out to be absolutely impossible. I want to read you, we've got time, yeah, I want to read you some stories. This is Fox's Book of Martyrs. We've been very comfortable for very long in this country, and it's pretty rare to have someone in this country killed for being a Christian, or even have sort of major physical hassle for it. The main group that do are Muslims who become Christian. Let me read you some of these stories. So these are in the years, the early years of being a Christian, just sort of what was normal. Let me read you some stories. Here we go. Nice story about Julius. Julius, a Roman senator, was ordered by the emperor to sacrifice to him as Hercules, to say the emperor is God. This Julius absolutely refused and publicly professed himself as a Christian. On this account, after remaining in prison a considerable time, he was beat to death with a club. Irenaeus, Bishop of Lyon, was born in Greece and received a Christian education. He was a zealous opposer of heresies in general and wrote a tract against heresy, which had great influence at the time. This pointed him out as an object of resentment to the emperor. He was accordingly beheaded in AD 202. The persecutions about this time extended to Africa, and many were martyred in that part of the globe, the principal of whom was Perpetua, a married lady of about 26 years of age, with an infant child at her breast. She was seized for being a Christian, and her father, who tenderly loved her, tried to persuade her to renounce Christianity. So there's the shield wall thing. Can you be pulled out of the shield wall? Perpetua, however, resisted every entreaty. On being carried before the proconsul Minutius, she was commanded to sacrifice to the idols. Refusing, she was ordered to a dark dungeon and deprived of her child. Perpetua gave the strongest proof of fortitude and strength of mind on her trial. The judge entreated her to consider her father's tears, her infant's helplessness, and her own life. But triumphing over all the sentiments of nature, that's a way of saying crazy, she forgot the thought of pain in the prospect of that immortality offered by Christ. She was first torn by wild beasts and then killed by the sword. Callistus, Bishop of Rome, was martyred in 224, and in 232 Urban, one of his successors, met the same fate. Agapetus, a boy of Praeneste in Italy, who was only 15 years of age, refusing to sacrifice to the idols, was severely scourged and then hanged up by the feet and boiling water poured over him. He was afterwards worried by wild beasts and at last beheaded. Let's do one more. Go on page 20. In the year 274, so a bit later on, the Emperor Aurelian began to persecute the Christians. The principal sufferer was Felix, Bishop of Rome, again, not a good job to have, who was advanced to the Roman See in 274, was beheaded in the same year. Diocletian, mounting the imperial throne in 284, at first showed great favour to the Christians. Then in 286, he associated Maximian with him in the emperor, who didn't like Christians. When Felician and Primus, two Christian brothers, were put to death before any general persecution broke out. So let's have their story. So Felician and Primus, were seized by an order from the imperial court, and owning themselves to be Christians, were scourged, tortured, and finally beheaded. Then here's another two. Marcus and Marcellianus, twin natives of Rome and of noble descent, were also apprehended, severely tortured, and then condemned to death. A respite of a month was obtained for them, that their parents and relations might try to bring them back to paganism. So that's quite clever, isn't it? You get them in, you torture them, you nearly kill them, you condemn them to death, then you give them a month at home. And their parents tried to persuade them, but it was in vain. At last, their constancy subdued their persuaders, and the whole family became converts. And at Tranquillinius, his father, the father was sent for by the prefect, and when he confessed that so far from having been able to persuade his sons to forsake Christianity, he had become a Christian himself. In accounting for the change, he used such powerful arguments that he made a convert of the prefect. who soon after sold his estate, resigned his command, and spent the remainder of his days in pious retirement. It's quite extraordinary. And that was sort of, it wasn't every year all the time, but regularly again and again and again. Do you see how hard it is to pull someone off the shield wall if they're convinced that to die is gain? There's a conversation I couldn't find, but this is a conversation between a Roman emperor and a Christian, and it goes like this. He says, look, if you don't stop being a Christian, I will take away all your property, rich man. And this guy says, well, your honour, emperorship, you can't really take away my property, because you see, I do have a house in Rome and estates outside, but really my property is in Christ, and my life is in Christ, and you are incapable of taking him away. So then he says, look, I'll take away your freedom. And he says, well, awkward, but I'm sorry, you can't really do that. See, I am free anywhere that Christ is, and you cannot keep him out of my prison cell. Then he says, I will take away your life. And he says, well, I pray to God I will have courage to honour Christ in my body. I hope the pain doesn't make me squeak, because the truth is that the dying bit is fine, because it is gain, because Christ is better. And the Roman emperor has to give up talking him down. There is no way to pull someone out of the shield wall whose life's values are set like that. He just has to execute him in frustration. Isn't this crazy, crazy, crazy talk? Again, please hear me. This is not me. Not easily. And the last two talks, tomorrow night and Sunday morning, will be how and why Paul gets there. But for now, let me just read through verse 17 again. Then I'm going to pray. Because he tells us to imitate him. And find anybody you know who is a bit like this, a bit crazy like this, and keep your eyes on them and imitate them too. So 3 verse 17, brothers and sisters, join in imitating me and keep your eyes on those who walk according to the example you have in us. Let's pray. Father God, thank you so much for Paul's example, for the amazing way he reacted, the fact he could rejoice in both those situations. Please, please help us imitate. Help us fix our eyes on people like that. Praise you for Becca and her attitude to her cancer. Praise you for Christian brothers and sisters at St. Helens who've been Muslims and their attitude as they face their family's anger. And praise you for those around us who are able to take rivalry and smile, and those around us who take setbacks and smile, and that we would try and follow them, walk after them in this crazy way of the gospel. And Lord, please would you use that to keep us united and to keep us standing firm, so that we can hold out Christ as effectively, as well, as long as we can, as long as you give us strength and life. We ask this in his name. Amen.